The E-Commerce Uncovered podcast is a behind-the-scenes look at what makes e-commerce a success in today's ever-growing and continually changing online world. The podcasts look to uncover the secrets of e-commerce success so you can learn and apply to your own online business. Brought to you by the co-founders of Core Fulfillment, one of the UK's leading e-commerce fulfillment providers, Paul Burns and Jeremy Vernon.
Hi, it's Jeremy Vernon here, and welcome to another episode of E-Commerce Uncovered. GDPR is a big subject that everyone seems to be talking about at the moment, so I thought what a timely way to cover that in the podcast. So I'm very grateful for Andrew Wasdell, who's joined me today, who is a GDPR practitioner. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Hi, yeah.
Okay, let's get into it, because I'm sure there's a lot to cover here. First and foremost, the General Data Protection Regulation, or known as GDPR.
Yep.
Can you just give us a quick overview of what's coming and why it's such a talking point for businesses at the moment?
Okay. It's been in place or available to use, if that's the right phrase, for 2 years. I mean, that's the point. It came in May 16, but it actually applies from May the 25th this year. And that's a European-wide regulation. So it's going to affect all the data subjects in the EU, all firms, if we're particularly focused on commercial operations, then obviously all firms operating in the EU, and that includes firms based outside the EU, but who obviously sell to EU data subjects.
My understanding is this is the biggest change in data protection in the last 20 odd years, so yeah. Quite a big thing for businesses to take on.
Yeah.
What are the major changes that is different to the old data protection rules that we're used to?
Okay. Well, obviously, we've got the Data Protection Act 1998. So that tells you, obviously, there that we're talking something that's 20 years old, very early days of the internet and the likes. So the world has obviously moved on, e-commerce in particular, the whole digital world in particular has moved on. Whilst it affects all data protection, I think that's where people's real concerns are. The thing that I stress to people about this regulation and what it's embedded in is the fact that it's principle based. So it really lays down as a regulation that you have to proactively manage the data and the data subject and their privacy, as opposed to just worrying about, do I need to react in the right way if something goes wrong? It talks about making organizational and technical measures or putting those in place. And then whilst it gives you some more detail, that phrase in itself doesn't give you a lot to go on. It puts the onus on the organisation to put those measures in place and demonstrate that you have got organisation, you've got controls, you're operating on a legal basis in the first place. And so whilst a lot of the core of the Protection Act 1998 is still in there, there are various aspects that have been enhanced, strengthened, and the likes, but it's that principle of being proactive and behaving in what's called a principle, what I call principle-based regulation, is the main thing that I think people are grappling with.
Yeah, there seems, certainly from what I've seen, there seems to be a huge amount of misunderstanding or confusion, grey areas about what people are. And it'd be good to go over a few of the basic definitions, I suppose, that we hear banding around at the moment.
Yeah.
So there's four here that I think be worth just clarifying what they actually are.
Yep.
So a data subject. Mm-hmm. What's a data subject?
Well, a data subject is basically anybody residing within the EU. They don't have to be a national of the state, so it could be an American living in Brussels, and for that period they are an individual residing within the EU. Obviously, the rest of us that live here full time, well, by definition, we're obviously here. We're data subjects.
Yeah. Personal data. I know it might seem a simple thing to qualify, but what is classed as personal data in the context of GDPR?
It starts with, does the data identify you as an individual? Your name is obviously the key identifier. But then there are other identifiers as well, such as your national insurance number, your passport number, your driving license number. And then when it comes to commercial organisations as well, even your account number and your reference number that you might use. And then broadens out then into the information about the person, their dates of birth, their financial information is a whole category of data that will be of interest, their behaviours that are logged against them as an individual.
Okay. The final two, I think, are an element of confusion about which sort of camp people fall into here. The two are data processors and data controllers. Yeah. Would you like to just sort of quick overview what the difference between those two are?
Yeah. Well, if we start with the controller, so the regulation basically says that a controller is somebody who identifies the purpose and the manner of the processing. Again, and the one thing to bear in mind, I think, is that people who are controllers are typically processors as well. And they may keep all of that in-house. Now, having said that, there are people out there who are happy providing services in the commercial world in particular, where they will be processors. So you might engage with a firm to provide a service. You could very well do that service yourself. They might have the expertise, they might have the economies. That might involve you passing out their personal data for them to actually process. As the controller, you're making those decisions. The processor is just acting on your behalf.
Okay. So let's put it in context of e-commerce retailer. So they will collect personal data of the data subjects in various different ways, but the main ones is that someone will trade with them, they'll buy a product from them online, they'll supply them with all of their personal details, including delivery address. In that context, they're a data controller of that personal data.
Yeah.
Now, if they then, obviously, if they've got their own warehouse, if they fulfill that order to that customer, they're processing that data. So they're a data processor in that context, is that correct?
Yep.
If they've outsourced that to a fulfillment warehouse like ourselves, where does the sort of the responsibility, I suppose, of under GDPR to make sure that data is kept safe, secure, where does the liability lie for making sure that that data throughout the process is safe and secure?
It predominantly lies with the controller. Having said that, the processors are in scope and the regulator may be unhappy. There may be an issue with a processor and the regulator could take action against the processor. The regulator may go to the controller and the processor in that case. Yeah. But predominantly, I mean, this is where, again, where the regulator's putting the onus on the controller. Again, this is the thing I stress to my customers is, you know, you would do due diligence on somebody providing you with a service of a commercially important nature, particularly, obviously, again, if there are sensitivities to that activity in its own right. So, you know, you want to be dealing with firms who pass that due diligence test. And there are obviously particular security arrangements around data processing that you should be interested in now in particular.
Okay. So if I'm an e-com retailer, I want to outsource my fulfillment to someone. What sort of check should I make to make sure that that data is going to be as secure as it needs to be to meet the regulations?
The ICO has given a lot of help there because there's actually eight clauses that they recommend go into a contract as mandatory clauses. Those clauses are fairly easy to understand. They should only act on written instructions, for example. They should make their staff aware of the importance of data protection, the need to operate when confidentiality is required. They should only operate on a confidential basis. And those 8 points carry on all the way through to particularly the security arrangements. There should be known and documented security arrangements in place. And that's, again, I think where firms need to be aware in particular that it's fairly easy for lawyers to draw up these standard terms into contracts and the like. What I always encourage, because it's not a lot of work, but it's a bit, is that you typically need an appendix at the back of a contract where the lawyers will have drafted all the standard terms. The lawyers typically won't, unless you explicitly ask them, to get involved in the detailed arrangements that are pertinent to that particular customer-supplier relationship, where you would maybe have named people responsible for things. You might have particular security arrangements that either you want or have been offered in relation to your particular agreement. And that's the sort of detail, again, and don't forget, this is all about being proactive. It's all about putting these things in place that stop data privacy issues arising in the future.
Certainly, if you're outsourcing information, a lot of that data will be transmitted via sort of closed systems, via sort of APIs, which are obviously internet-based. Is it down to the system to provide that level of security to ensure that there's no breaches, people can't access information when they're not sort of authorised to do so? Is it down to the system providers or is it down to the data processors? Where does that responsibility lie?
The thing about a data processing agreement, again, it's a common question. It's a joint agreement between the controller and the processor. Depends where the power is almost in the relationship drawing up the agreement commercially. You know, if you're a small firm and you deal with Amazon, you've not got a lot of say. But a well-written data processing agreement is an agreement. It's not particularly a contract of where you provide X to me. It's a mutual agreement which will cover, you know, whatever needs to be covered to preserve the privacy issues and deal with the privacy issues on both sides.
Coming back to e-com, obviously you might have a retailer that is taking obviously that information in the first place. They then pass that data to, let's say, an outsourced fulfillment operation. And obviously they have an agreement. But then, for example, obviously if something's going out in the courier network, there's a label printed with a significant amount of the personal data of the data subject. Mm-hmm. That's then passed through to the likes of DHL, DPD, Royal Mail, whoever. How does the relationship between the retailer and the courier then work?
It's an interesting one, this, because I've seen a couple of different interpretations of it. Personally, I believe that the courier networks are controllers in their own right. Because if you want to use a courier, if I want to engage with a courier, I'm not going to dictate to the courier particularly what information they need. It's for them to decide that and tell me that. I might not be happy with that, or I need to probably be aware of it. And if there was something spurious in the information that they appeared to need, you know, you might say, well, I'm not quite sure why you need that. It should be fairly self-evident, I would have thought, that a courier would only take the minimum information. Yeah. They then are controllers because they're going to want to keep their own records. They're going to decide. If you rang DPD tomorrow and said, can we delete all the information relating to our deliveries for the last 3 months, please? I'm sure they'd say no. Whereas a typical processor-controller relationship, you would have that sort of authority, if you like. They can delete the data. And certainly should delete the data when the end of the agreement comes. So that's what it's a test in a way you can apply. And as I say, this controller processor labels aren't necessarily always clear. Because again, I think it's fairly self-evident that all the payment processors are controllers in their own rights. They're not a processor acting on your behalf in this sense. Whilst we know we're utilizing them, they're processing data. But again, if you spoke to any of the payment gateways and said, do we have total control of all of this data that you're actually holding? The answer is no. You know, the payment gateways all know that you know what they're working to their own standards, which are then payment industry standards in their own rights and the like. So it's not necessarily clear in all of these relationships how the land actually lies.
And that's what I'm sort of seeing people really not understanding, certainly whether they're a processor or they're a controller. And
yeah.
I saw, I think you mentioned, I think it was a post you put onto LinkedIn, it was about two delivery companies had two different views of what they should be. So obviously very related to e-com. Something you mentioned then about deleting data. I think, again, this is another area that certainly from my understanding is quite a lot of confusion. There's obviously sort of certain aspects of how long you should keep data for. Mm-hmm. The process for you to delete it. From a practical point of view, let's say an e-com retailer's perspective, in reality, what does it mean?
I mean, it's probably very applicable in the digital world. It comes back to the principle of the regulation in the first place. The regulators and the regulation is designed to stop the constant accumulation of data. So therefore, they're looking for firms to put in retention policies. And most firms have never considered it. Most firms have data going back from the day that they started or the day that that particular platform was put in place and started to be used. That's what the regulation is looking for. The regulation is looking for you to acknowledge that basically that's unacceptable to just have a never-ending accumulation. So therefore, the answer to that is to put in some policy around what you would do with a security arrangements in the first place. Identifying data subjects probably into categories of live customers, past customers, Maybe you've got mixed in there people who never actually transacted, but you ended up with their details through an abandoned inquiry or a cart abandonment or whatever. So it's about where is all this data, and then what management policies have we got around how long do we keep those? Now, a lot of people are getting a bit trigger happy, I think, and telling people, oh, you need to delete everything by May the 25th. And again, I would absolutely caution against that. But what you mustn't have is a head in the sand approach of saying, let's hope this goes away.
Come back to an e-commerce retailer. So they've got, as you say, that probably their system, if they've had that system a few years, they'll have all the data from a few years ago and all the customers that's ever bought and, as you say, you know, abandoned baskets, all that sort of stuff. In terms of length of time, what's reasonable these days under this new rule? Because customer might come back once every 2 years, they might come back every month. Mm. How long do they keep that data for within these rules in a sort of a reasonable sense?
I might be accused of ducking the issue on this. I think you've got to justify the reasonableness.
Okay.
So yes, somebody might come back in 2 years, but so what? Is that not just okay then? And if we've deleted the data after 6 months, but they came back after 2 years, then maybe 6 months is the right period. Maybe 3 years is the right period. But I think if you've got the data sat there in your system from somebody who's inquired 2 years ago, the question to ask yourself, do we really need this data? Why is it sat there, other than the fact that they entered it and we've never deleted it?
Okay. Obviously, there's lots of talk about if you are found to be in breach and the penalties as a result, and they're quite hefty by the sounds of it for non-compliance. Mm. Do you just want to talk a little bit about, first and foremost, what is considered a breach? Can we put it into a scenario so we really understand what that would be?
Okay. Well, a breach is where the systems have broken down and data has either been accessed by somebody who shouldn't access it, or we've found that we actually should have deleted a load of data that we've actually not deleted. I think the important point is you're expected to keep your internal record of all of these issues. And what the regulation's looking for there, and it's a bit like the old quality management world of complaints management, for example, where you go, well, let's take the value out of a complaint by getting to a root cause and trying to put systems in place to stop it happening again. That's exactly the type of approach that's being looked for breaches themselves. Now, the regulation then actually, though, requires is that if there's a significant risk to the individuals, then that's where you should notify the information commissioner and actually inform them, you know, that that's actually happened. Now, you need to be well ahead of the game, because their first question back to you will be, what have you done about it? So it shouldn't be a case of, this has happened, what should we do, Mr. Commissioner? It will be about, what have you already done?
So this is basically holding your hand up to your own issues, and by informing them of a breach, would that then automatically result in a fine?
No. The fines are split into the two levels, where the breaches, the significant breaches, are at the higher level of the up to 20 million euro type level. Lesser infringements of the regulation, where there's not necessarily a breach, is the 10 million euro lower level. It's within the gift of the commissioners to actually look at the impact, the scale of the issue. And the commissioner themselves have said that it will be about what steps you actually took, going back to this being proactive. So the big fines will come where firms have been discovered to have been either negligent or reckless. They've either done nothing or minimal, or they've known about something significant and the risk and not done anything to mitigate it. That's where fines probably of any type will come in. If you can show that you actually did a lot of work on this principle based of being proactive, then you're likely to get a, shall I say, more sympathetic hearing from the commissioner.
So just come back to a real example. So let's take our business. We make a policy that we obviously get information from all of our customers. So we're given through the system integrations that we have, personal details of everyone that we would send a parcel to. We make a decision that, for example, we keep that data for a year. Just to give an example timeline. And if we do that twice a year, we have a purge of that data twice a year, would that fall into the reasonable proactive stance of what we do with that data first and foremost?
Yeah.
So if we then, on the 6 month anniversary, forget to delete a set of data, that would be considered a breach of the new rules.
Yeah. Well, it's a breach of your policy, isn't it? Which is, yeah.
Under that circumstance, we internally discover we haven't deleted that data on the sort of 6 month anniversary when we said we would do it.
Yeah.
We then need to go to the ICO and tell them that there's been a breach and we haven't followed our own, in effect, our own rules to cover this data. As you say, their first question to us would be, so what have you done about it?
Mm-hmm.
And we would say, reassess, we've deleted the data and we've made sure that we'll have a more robust reminder system for that those 2 dates in the year to assess data.
Mm.
In that circumstances, what do you think the ICO would do? Would we potentially get a fine?
Yeah, it's a dangerous thing for me to speak on behalf of the Commissioner. Appreciate that. I would imagine no is the quick, short answer. Possibly undertakings, you know, that, as I say, they would look at what you've already done. If they were happy with what you've already done, get an acknowledgement back that says, we're okay with that, providing you, mate, you now stick with it. Yeah. If they're unhappy with what you've done, they may would like you to, you know, give more undertakings, whatever it is they're unhappy with.
Yeah. Just as a, you know, a new business, this is a new way of working. It's a very self-assessment style sort of way of working.
Mm.
Presuming in the UK is the ICO we'd go to.
Mm-hmm.
What is the incentive for us to phone the ICO and say, actually, we've been in breach? Because if we rectify that breach internally, for example, how would they ever know we've been in breach at any point in time?
Well, they wouldn't necessarily. It's a little bit like the seatbelt law that I quote to people, which, you know, if I drove home from here without my seatbelt on, could I get away with it? Probably. Once, I'm sure over a number of occasions, there'll come a time where I don't manage to get away with it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what they're looking for. I mean, they would regard the non-reporting of something that should be reporting as recklessness, basically, where you're aware of it and you've not done it. You would get a very, you know, difficult reaction from them just on that basis.
How is the ICO, what will they be doing sort of after the 25th of May? Obviously, just in terms of the timing, we're just over 2 weeks away from that deadline. By the time this actually goes out on the podcast, we'll be slightly less than that.
Mm.
As of the 25th of May, what is going to happen? What's going to change for businesses in terms of they put their policies in place, they put their internal processes in place, they follow those? Are the ICO going to come knocking on the door randomly and say, we want to come and check your data protection regulations?
Yeah. Well, again, very unlikely. I would imagine it's very much like the FCA, who again have limited resources in terms of being able to manage, you know, the market as a whole. And so the answer typically comes from complaints from the members of the public. You know, there might be a theme to complaints, you know, where more than one individual's got an issue, is obviously a source for them. They may very well do what got described as thematic type reviews, where they might be concerned about a particular sector. You know, they might invite themselves in, or you might get invited to take part, you know, in a study that they're doing on a particular sector.
Okay. What sort of powers are they going to have? Have they got increased powers from sort of now after the
20th? Well, it's just the application of the regulation. I mean, there was this furore, wasn't there, at the Cambridge Analytica, you know, the access to search their premises. And so, I mean, that we're still waiting for that under the Data Protection Bill, which is the British legislative equivalent or replacement to A of the DPA 1998. And it also deals with Brexit and will leave it on the British statute book as a British law. So it's more the ICO can enforce GDPR. There are more rules or principles to be broken now within the scope of GDPR, and the penalties are available to them.
Email seems to be a real common thing at the moment, that this whole sort of concept of consent and opting in, opting out, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody's in the same boat at the moment, but we just seem to, our email inboxes just seem to be full of people going, we need you to consent, re-opt in to our email to be able to communicate with you after the 25th.
Yeah.
Are there some misconceptions and misunderstandings around email at the moment that you're seeing?
Well, yes, I think is a short answer. It's difficult to see what's happening behind the scenes, because I think the point really is, what records do these firms actually have? They've obviously got your email address to send you the email. I don't know whether they've got a marker that says what date they've had that email address since. I don't know whether they've got the content of the consent notice that was used on that date.
So is an historical consent acceptable under the new rules?
If it was to the standard of the new rules, then yes. And the reason I say that is that this has been in place for 2 years, and the ICO has had best guidance out for a while. So if you have been working to those, then yeah, it is highly likely that your consent is actually good enough. The problem with GDPR is you've got to be able to show that you have obtained it in line with the new requirement, or the GDPR level requirement, shall we call it.
Now, there's businesses out there that will sell data for marketing purposes, so your cold calling list, or a specific data for a specific sort of industry.
Yeah.
Now, presumably they're the data controller in this context, but they might sell you data so you can do some marketing for your own business to try and obviously build your business. How does all of this affect that type of data that you see sort of people here as a database of e-com retailers or whoever it may be?
Well, it comes down really to what I was talking about before about due diligence. I would caution that people do ask some serious questions around the offer of some data on that basis, because you're going to want to know, where did this data come from? Can you show me maybe the consent wording that was actually used? What's its origins? I mean, A, it's a reputation thing. B, you would absolutely be in the line of illegally emailing people that you shouldn't be emailing, basically. If you sent out 100,000 emails just based on the fact that somebody offered me these email addresses and they said they were okay. You can't pass the buck, if you like, back to the supplier on that.
So advice there would be to do your own due diligence, as you say, make sure that that has been collected in a way that would satisfy current regulations, even though it'd be historical data. I mean, there's Wetherspoons, isn't it, that are just deleting all of their database and coming off social media altogether. What do you make of that? Is that just a real knee-jerk reaction?
Or he's done it as a marketing ploy in itself.
Well, it's got a lot of press. Are you seeing businesses react like this to a real sort of, we don't know what to do, so we're just going to delete everything that we've got?
Yeah, I think the problem lies in the databases that they've actually got and the content of those databases and their ability to reference back to how that consent was actually applied. And then what the more sophisticated approaches or the more proactive approaches are adopting is this, where they may be offering subscriber dashboards for people to use for the first time, where you can opt into various types of communication and opt out of others, as opposed to just having "Are you happy to receive emails?" type single box. So again, a lot of the brand driven type segments are moving more and more towards that. You know, particularly the hospitality sector, for example, all the hotel chains where if you're in the loyalty schemes and the likes of, some recruitment agencies are all doing that as well.
Okay, one of the things I want to sort of talk about is where people are using software to profile people. So an example of that would be, and we get called by people that provide this sort of service all the time, but it's where people obviously go to your website, they'll profile them using, IP addresses and all sorts of things. So that person will never certainly consent to give you their details. Now, they may accept your cookies on your website policy, but you obviously then effectively harvest that data through quite clever means of where they're coming from and cross-referencing various different things. Mm. So you can ultimately find or try to find out who they are. Mm. How does that sort of data fall into the new regulation? Because there's no consent there at all from a "here's my email address, please contact me" type consent, is there?
No. One of the rights the data subject gets, amongst a number of others, is to object to automated decision making and profiling. So particularly in an online environment, you need to be included in your privacy notice that you're intending to do that. You should be making it clear to them that, you know, in non-legalistic language, almost preferably without using the word profiling, because a lot of people wouldn't understand what that actually means. And the ICO guidance, again, always talks about using user-friendly language in these scenarios. So with respect to any lawyers listening, it's almost a bad decision to ask a lawyer to draft some of these notices. But yeah, they get the right to object to that. Now, they could accept the privacy notice at the time, in which case they're accepting, you know, that it will happen. They could then object later down the line, and your privacy notice needs to say how they go about objecting to it and whether that's even possible. I mean, as per the Facebook scenario, there's going to be some interesting developments and probable court cases over all of that.
So take that as an example. So someone comes on our site, our terms and conditions and our privacy notice on our site says we are collecting this data and we could use this for our own purposes. And we decide, we see through one of these sort of analytical type profiling softwares that a certain person from a particular company has been on our site, didn't do anything, didn't leave any contact details. And then we decide to contact them relatively soon. So they haven't come to us and said they want the right to be forgotten. Are we in breach at that point, or because they haven't requested anything with that data, we're okay to follow that up?
I'd have to look at it a bit more closely, okay. But
I think that there's lots and lots of scenarios in there.
Yeah.
What if?
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about marketing activity, GDPR particularly highlights marketing and gives the data subject the right to object to it, remove themselves from it, and the likes, whether that's through initial consent in the first place, which is the most typical traditional way of doing it. The whole profiling aspect is, you know, as we said, it's maybe a bit of a grey area.
Okay.
But yeah, it's going to be interesting.
It is. So just another scenario, when people fall onto it or land on a website for the first time, under the new rules, are they to be asked certain questions before they sort of continue? Now, you obviously usually get these cookie notices or privacy notices actually that come up as a pop-up or a banner or something.
Mm.
Has that got to happen so people have the choice of what can happen with their data at that point on their first visit to a particular site?
The GDPR talks about as you collect the data, they need to be made aware of what that is. You know, and that's where the delivery of the privacy notice comes in. Now, having said that, again, there is, and the ICO actually promote this, is this ability to have these messages that sort of appear when you hover over the box and it tells you what the content of that particular field is going to be used for. Because, you know, again, whilst most people are referring to privacy notices and drafting multi-hundred, if not thousand word privacy notices,
which are hidden somewhere down in
the
site,
then they're not user-friendly, are they? And people do not either read all or certainly some of the important bits of them.
I mean, a great example probably of that would be someone's mobile number, for example.
Yeah.
Now, if you, as an e-com retailer, if you're using a text-based tracking service like DPD, it's best to obviously collect the data subject's mobile number. Now, not every courier wants that or needs that information, but if you're using, for example, as I say, DPD or even a Royal Mail, or there are others, you would take that information. Presumably, because that's not always taken at the point of sale, would you then, in that scenario, have to say why you're collecting a mobile number?
Yeah, it's not clear from the example, but yeah. I mean, it's about transparency. This is the point. You know, I think people are potentially seeing a conflict between the commerce and the transparency. And the people who will win on this will have the complementary view of the commerce and the transparency. It's like I said about the profiling, you know, the least you should have on there is a message that says, you know, we intend to profile your data behavior. To not even mention it at all is totally opaque and nowhere close to transparency. Now, as to how explicit you have to be and the likes, you know, you've got to balance that, you know, and people have got to be able to understand it. You've got to time the delivery of the information like we just talked about. You know, it's all judgment calls, and there's a lot of opportunities on creativity around website design, customer journey, and the likes.
Hugely complex and confusing area. Another thing, sort of just as an example for specifically e-commerce retailers. So let's say a retailer has a way of signing up to a newsletter, sort of a marketing type data collection. And obviously, they could have the data collection through someone purchasing one of their products. Can those two sets of data be used for the same thing now or not? Buying a product, in effect, are you consenting to be able to be marketed to in a future date?
You shouldn't be. I mean, it needs to be clear.
A tick box of an opt-in, yes, please, let you can contact me in future.
Consent has got to be freely given, explicit, and reversible.
If people have historic data where those two things are very separate and they haven't got clear consent, what are they best doing with that data?
I wouldn't say delete it. I was in a customer last week and they had this problem of a database that goes back forever. I said, how old is your oldest record? And I said, what's the open rate on emails to that customer? If the open rate is zero, then do you want to keep them anyway?
Yeah.
You know?
Common sense, I suppose, from that perspective.
If that customer is actually opening 25% of those emails, let's have another look at the situation. Do some business analysis on your marketing database, in essence. Do a 360 on it. Get a group of people in a room and say, well, what different things could we look at here? I don't know whether cross-referencing against traditional hard copy post and the mail shot and the likes. You know, some people do that, some people don't.
Okay, I know this is a huge subject, so we probably talk for hours on this and still not even scratch the surface. So I'm just conscious that to end this, and obviously we'll ask you, obviously, if people want to get in contact with you and discuss sort of their particular scenarios with you, then they can get in contact. But from the work that you've done so far and all the different businesses that you've spoken to regarding this, what's the biggest misconception that you're seeing over GDPR?
The first thing that happens really is that we talk about context and an actual example. With all respect to the ICO, there's a lot of guidance on the ICO website, but everybody I speak to, you know, everybody who's read that, still want to work through an example in their world and how it actually applies to them. Other than that, most people really haven't really dug into, you know, most SMEs don't have the resource probably of the time to have dug into this. And so they've heard of GDPR. But they're unsure, you know, where to even start.
Yeah, that's certainly the impression and one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast today. Thank you very much for giving your time. That's great. I think it's a great overview of, certainly reassures, hopefully, people that it isn't the end of the world, is it, from a data perspective?
No.
A lot of it's about common sense and putting, as you say, a proactive stance in place. If anyone listening is struggling or needs a bit more clarification of how they're sort of dealing with GDPR. And obviously this is going to go on for years, isn't it? This isn't just the sort
absolutely.
As of the 25th of this month, it's all in place and everyone forgets about it. Because I guess it's a continuous improvement type program as well, where they reassess, we're not good enough for here, we'll put this in place.
Yep.
So if someone wants to know more or they've got a specific problem and they want to come and ask you about it or engage your services, how can someone get in contact with you?
Okay, well, I'm on LinkedIn, Andrew Wisedale. I've got GDPR Journey as my company name, but that is just me at the moment, so you'll definitely get me. My email address is andrew@gdprjourney.co.uk.
Once again, thank you very much for joining us.